previously.tv podcast network.
I'm not trying to be an ass to you, but we're dealing with life here, buddy.
Dick Wolf is trying to become the oxygen in your true crime atmosphere with yet another show, his new The First 48 meets the closer joint, Criminal Confessions. I'm trying to break bad and break format with Uproxx's Alan Sepinwall. This is The Blotter Presents, episode 27. Hello, everybody. This is The Blotter Presents, previously.tv's take on TV true crime. I'm joined this time out by, well, Alan, if I'm the Giardello of this podcast, who are you in this scenario?
I want to say that I'm the Pembleton, but I'm probably more likely the Beau Felton. And, you know, I'm going to screw up and get kicked off the course.
I would have gone with Pembleton, but I wanted to give you the option. And as long as you're not the D'Onofrio cut in half by a train, we're probably good. Anyway, folks, Alan Sepinwall is with me today. He is the author of The Revolution Was Televised, TV the Book, and the brand new Breaking Bad 101, The Complete Critical Companion.
Hello, Alan. Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Anytime. We are, as I mentioned, getting into it with our most wanted section on, once again, a Dick Wolf property. Criminal Confessions airs Sundays on Oxygen. They're doing that weird split drop where it airs at 7 and 9, I believe. It's basically, it's like the other side of Netflix's The Confession Tapes, which we covered in a previous episode. This is a behind-the-scenes look at how investigators get people to confess. The pilot involved oil boomer Robert Early, who called Carlsbad, New Mexico police in March of 2014 to report that his girlfriend of 4 months, Emily Lambert, was missing. The real story was quite a bit different. After a fight over another guy flirting with Lambert at a bar, Early knocked her out, put her in his truck unconscious, beat her with an air pump when she came to, and dragged her 500 yards behind his truck to the middle of a field where he left her. When he returned the next day to check, he found her dead from her injuries. How did cop get Early to bring himself to admit the truth? All right, so let's get into a discussion of this show by my asking you, Alan, how much true crime do you watch generally?
Not a ton. It's sort of if something breaks out of the pack a little bit, like The Jinx, or, you know, at least I watch part of Making a Murderer, I will go for it. Just sort of with peak TV, I've cut a lot of nonfiction out of my viewing diet just because there's just not enough time.
Yeah, even running this podcast, there's a lot of stuff that slips through the cracks for me. But because I do have this podcast, I am intimately familiar with certain tropes of this nonfiction genre, at least Oxygen and Investigation Discovery's version of it, which is a lot of repetitive filler before and after ad breaks, a lot of gauzy, out-of-focus reenactments, so on and so forth. I felt that this was fairly well done, given what I was expecting. What did you think?
I thought it was solid. It's, as you say, it's padded. It could have been maybe two-thirds, if not half, the length of what it actually was to get to the point, but it takes you through step-by-step what a case like this would be like and how the cops work the witness turned suspect in the interview room slowly but surely, and it's not poetic like on Homicide, which we were joking about before, but there you see these little sort of strategies and the different ways that the different cops wind up approaching it. And one of the best parts I liked was midway through, they send a completely different detective in to try to close the case just because they want someone with a different relationship than the other two guys have had. And I liked seeing that pivot and understanding the psychology of it.
Yeah, I like that too. And they actually do that a couple of times. There's one guy that has been in the interrogation room, and then they talk about, it's not exactly the good cop, bad cop. It's more like the first cop, second cop, to try to switch things up. And they talk a little bit about that in clip two.
If I'm getting to a point where either I'm getting frustrated or I'm running out of the questions I need to be asking, I'll get up and I'll walk out. Yeah, we use it as a strategy quite a bit. It opens Scott up to be able to start talking to him or asking questions.
A lot of times I'll just stay back in that chair and start heading directions that he wasn't hitting.
Was it noticeable that y'all had an argument?
I mean, no.
If someone was sitting at the table next to you all or in the area today?
I mean, I kept it pretty much as discreet as I could.
So I thought that was interesting. And I was also interested in some information that we got on the polygraph, which I sort of, as a true crime consumer, don't have a ton of use for if it's not admissible in court. But I thought their explanation of this particular kind of polygraph, which I guess is only 3 questions. Was that your understanding?
It seemed like he was just asking variants on, if not those 3 questions, then a handful of total questions over and over to see how the guy reacted each time. And I feel like if I was, you know, being subject to that, whether I was innocent or guilty, eventually all of my vitals would be leaping because I would just be so annoyed at being asked the question over and over. But I don't know. I find polygraphy to be kind of a voodoo science, but they must have some sort of motivation behind it.
Well, I think it's interesting that they have this method that they use. Let's hear clip 3 and then we'll keep talking about it.
Do you know where Emily Lambert is located?
No.
Do you know where Emily Lambert is located right now?
No.
The particular test that I utilize is called the Utah 3. The 3 relevant questions are just reworded. It's just asking the same question again and again.
Do you know where Emily Lambert is located right now?
No.
You know the location of Emily Lambert today?
No.
Yeah, I mean, I would have the same response as you, which is that my blood pressure would spike hearing the way that law enforcement mangles the English language. They always say utilize when they just mean use. It's always a vehicle, never a car. So, yeah, I also wondered, and they didn't really get into this, although they may in future episodes, that they talked a little about how classic this suspect's response was to being told that he had failed the poly.
Yes.
And I was hoping they would get in a little bit more into how often they claim a suspect failed the poly when it was actually more like may indicate deception or passed just fine, but they want to get more information. And they didn't really get into that. So I hope they cover that in future episodes.
It feels like something that they would definitely have to talk about sooner or later, because, you know, one of the things we know is that police can use deception. You know, you can't use it in the court of law, but in the interview room, you can lie through your teeth to the suspect because, you know, it's only going to hurt someone who's guilty in theory.
Yeah, that's true. And you, after an interrogation has been going on for 12 or 15 hours, that's when you run into problems with the not admissibility, but the sort of utility of a confession at that point. But I'm going to play another clip. And then because you are a parent, I would like to ask you if you heard anything familiar here. Here's clip 4.
One of 2 kinds of people. One, some that accident happened. Or 2, you deal with a monster.
And you're not a monster.
Huh?
I said, I'm not a monster.
You're not a monster?
No.
Convince me of that right now, because, dude, you coming forward with that right there and saying that, and you've been hiding it for 2 days, I have a problem with.
When you give a person a choice, then it puts it all back on them, and they want to believe that, hey, they're not a monster, that, you know, this bad things happened, and I'm sorry. So in giving them those choices, you give them an out. And that out is, you're going to tell me the truth. It's just going to be in a roundabout way.
This is not an exact analog, but I personally could not help thinking of when my nibblings were toddlers and my sister-in-law would be like, okay, you have 2 choices. Did that strike you the same way?
Very much. You know, we've had some kids who like to not admit to things until they are absolutely 100% cornered into having to do it. And so you can feel a little bit like a cop in an interrogation room. And that strategy rang true to me.
Yeah. Like I'm sure it wasn't your fault. I'm sure it was your sibling, but you just got to tell me what happened. and then start donating your allowance to the Fix the Lamp Fund. Yeah, that just, I mean, I thought it was very smart, but it also made me laugh a little bit because I just thought about, you know, how you have to present toddlers with choices to get them to do what you actually want them to do sometimes. And then our next clip is the closer. And I should note that the show breaks up the case with little title cards like The Call and, you know, the inciting incident or whatever it is. And then here's Alan Sanchez, the closer, in clip 5.
Alan Sanchez, that guy can talk a talk, and he didn't have any problems throwing himself under the bus to get what we need.
I'm not married for a reason. It's because I'm a hoe bag. All right? Straight up. And it's because I've been in different relationships and stuff, man. So I know how it goes, and it can get real heated. You can get jealous. Jealousy is a powerful thing, man, especially when you're drunk.
You referred to this guy earlier. Do you want to talk a little more about the closer, the role of the closer on this show?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've watched a lot of cop dramas over the years. I got into this doing NYPD Blue, watching Homicide, even The Closer itself, Kira Sedgwick. And, you know, all of those are really, they're sort of verbally dexterous and clever because they have Hollywood writers behind them. This guy doesn't have that, but you still sort of see how he has a particular repertoire that he uses and that he can incorporate because he's coming into the case at the end and doesn't have the history of the guy having lied to him for 2 days, which could taint the relationship with the earlier cop. So I enjoyed watching that a lot. I mean, it's, again, this is not glamorous. It's not stylized, and they try to dress it up with those title cards and segment things, but it's like, that's real police work is not as fancy, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I liked that this was fairly stripped down. I also do enjoy the first 48. There's only so much of it I can watch in a single sitting, but, I do like that. Like, I appreciate that because this is not a podcast. There are certain things they have to do to get it to 43 minutes and to create visual interest beyond the very poor quality interrogation video. They don't abuse those things on this show versus Disappeared, which is nothing but out of focus shots of people's feet, basically. But I liked that this, first of all, that this detective in interviews, he sort of like becomes the like lead detective in the back half of the episode. And in later Talking Head interviews, he is clearly like pretty disgusted with how he had to bond, quote unquote, with this guy to, you know, gain his trust and get that confession. Like, he understands that this is the job, but he's also clearly like, yeah, well, so I got him to talk to me and a question mark.
Yeah, there's kind of this built-in jaded cynicism that you have to have when doing this job, but it's still dealing with really the scum of the earth sometimes. And this is not a good guy, and to have to even, you know, for a couple of hours, pretend like you relate to him, you know, I don't care how long you've been doing this job, that can't be an easy thing to get past.
Yeah, especially when he's sort of like, I've never, you know, the suspect is like, well, I'd never been with a woman this big, and she like stepped to me and then she bit me. And when he's trying to rationalize what he did to her, it's like, okay, yeah, that's the worst. And there are a number of moments where the cops are talking about the case and still get emotional about it.
Yes.
But I also liked the revelation that one of the detectives that we hear in the beginning of the show, who first sort of caught the case, was pulled out by his lieutenant because he's like, well, you know, let me have another run at this guy. And he's like, no. Like, now that we found the body, you're all head up and you need to have a seat and someone else is going to take it. So I thought that was interesting that that really does happen. And it's not just this Elliot Stabler, you know, fantasy of scripted TV.
Some cops do care too much, darn it.
As they should.
Yes.
I think that's important. Sanchez also takes us into our final clip where it's clear that Robert Early is about to say exactly what happened. But first, he has to have a smoke. And Sanchez is like feeling around in his pocket for this recorder in case Early spills his guts like in the parking lot, and then they don't have a recording of it. And here's why he can't just like bring him back upstairs and be like, just say everything that you just told me in our final clip.
Let's start from the beginning, man. And like, no bullshit, no nothing. Okay. No bullshit, no nothing.
It's going to be kind of hard to go, okay, so when you said you kicked her square in the face, can you, you know, go through that with me one more time? You can't do that. You're leading them. And everything that is said after that is not admissible in court. I didn't want to mess up any chance of Emily getting any kind of, you know, justice, you know, and it'd be my fault.
Yeah, I thought that was good. I thought it was interesting. I don't think I would have known that that's where the line is in terms of what the DA is going to tell them. We can or can't use this.
Yeah, and there's also just a sense of, like, he's going to say it once and then not going to want to talk about it again or be more comfortable saying it out there in the parking lot while having the smoke break and less so in the room. And so long as it's all admissible, you know, he better be able to get the recording right there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, this is the kind of a little bit more, I like behind the scenes law enforcement stuff well enough, but there is often this not fluffing of law enforcement, but this kind of unwillingness to show some of the more, like, not gritty is not the right word, but like, sometimes when you have the cooperation of law enforcement, I believe you as a, you know, producer of this kind of content are or may feel obligated to fluff their journeys a little bit. This doesn't do that, but it's still really processy. My question about the show is, how long is that going to sustain my interest now that I've seen it once or, you know, a couple times? Like, how long can this series go? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, you said you wanted me to watch the pilot episode, which I did, and that if I had time, I would get to the second one. I didn't have. But watching the pilot, I thought, all right, this is very good, and I feel like I kind of get the tricks. And obviously, there are many more tricks that you have to use when you're an interrogator, but at a certain point, I feel like you definitely, that runs out. And these, the cases themselves are not incredibly interesting. He's a bad guy who did something on impulse and, you know, did many stupid things after that, but he's not a criminal mastermind. It's not like Olivia Dabo from Criminal Intent or something. So, you know, at that,
oh, Nicole Wallace reference. That's why you're such a gem, Alan.
It's, you know, I'm here for you, Sarah. I'm here. Once you get past the processy stuff, how much of a show is there and how much process is there that they can dole out over a season, over multiple seasons?
Well, that's my question. Like, I think that this might be best suited as a limited series and they try to get every kind of case that they can, because I would watch like an entire season of them interrogating art and currency forgers, but I'm weird like that. Or like identity thieves and stuff like that. Like, there are a lot of different takes on crime that they can go through this process and bring us through the process with. But not infinite. There's only so many. So I'm hoping they have like 8 and then they stop. But I don't think that's going to happen because it's Dick Wolf and he's the kudzu of TV right now. So.
What season okay is Special it, Victims Unit in at the moment?
19. Don't.
Wow.
Yeah, it's bad.
Wow.
It's bad. Cassidy is back right now to investigate Benson for alleged child abuse. Because, obviously.
Didn't they date?
Yeah. Twice.
Okay, so how is that working exactly?
I can't even talk about it. Really can't talk
about it. I'm sorry.
Even though we have an explicit rating on this show. So I take it it's peak TV and you have other things on your plate right now. We'll get to those later, but I take it you're not going to continue watching this, but you won't be mad at it if it's on in a waiting room. Is that accurate?
No, it's totally fine. I would only be mad if it's on in a waiting room where I'm there with my kids, which I'm finding more and more is becoming an issue. Like, everywhere you go, there is a TV and the TV is often tuned to things that, like, I don't want them necessarily seeing. You know, go to get the oil changed and suddenly, hey, murder coverage.
Yeah. Well, Yeah. I mean, Oxygen now used to be sort of like some of it's fluffy, not fluffy anymore. Yeah. I think I'll put it on the DVR and we'll see how motivated I am to keep up with it. But I think it's definitely a solid outing. It's a little less soggy than Cold Justice, which I liked fine, but did not love from Dick Wolf. So yeah, we'll see. We'll see how much of a priority I make it. I probably will let it stack up and then watch it on a hungover Sunday. And that is our most wanted section. We're doing something a little different for Cold Case this week. Alan's got a lot to do. Peak TV, don't you know? So I thought instead of dragging him by his heels through a vintage 48 hours about some cold case, that I would you rather some famous cases with him vis-a-vis true crime showrunners. In other words, who should cover this case? Ryan Murphy of American Crime Story or Dick Wolf of Law and Order, True Crime, The Menendez Murders? And can I just file another objection to how long that title is? So, Alan, I put a list in our rundown doc of these cases. Are there any that I need to strike, or are you comfortable addressing all of them?
Let's do it.
All right. So top of the order is Stephen Avery of Making a Murderer. Who would you like to see take on the scripted version of this? Murphy or Wolf?
All right. This feels like there's not really a good answer here, because one of the things that we're finding from Menendez so far, which I know you like more than I do, is like the case itself doesn't necessarily lend itself to many, many hours of TV. Dick Wolf doesn't seem to quite know what to do with it, or Wolf and Ball say. And on the other hand, like, I don't know from what I saw of Making a Murderer that there is quite enough of the sociological commentary that is what made People vs. OJ so good to begin with. And I feel like Ryan Murphy coming in there, it would just be sort of commentary on, you know, extremely poor Midwestern people. And I don't know that.
Yeah, that's a good
right
point.
What about you?
Yeah, you don't have to pick, but if I were death is not an option in this, I would actually go Murphy and just keep it about the trial part and about Jerry Buting and what's his name? Strang. Because I think Murphy can be more restrained than sometimes we think he can. All right, yes, yeah,
especially with indeed. The right
collaborator. And if he's using his cast, is like standard stable of actors, I think that could be something really interesting if he took like a very narrow slice of the case and just kept it very small C Catholic in that regard. Okay. Would you rather Murphy or Wolf, Jeffrey McDonald, Green Beret murderer, star, quote unquote, of Fatal Vision, both book and movie? Gary Cole was in the original. They've been talking about remaking it for years. It never quite happens. Who should take that one on, Murphy or Wolf?
Well, first of all, I think Gary Cole, you shave his beard off and you dye his hair a little bit and he could still play the part.
Cause yeah, it's true.
That guy does not age. I think this feels more like a Wolf to me. And again, you have to figure out how many episodes he can fill of it, but just like everything I remember of book, movie, just the story in general feels like an extended Law and Order episode.
Actually, it's sort of the LA triptych. I think he could do it that way. I know I'm the only one who liked that, but it's on all the time and I kind of love it. Yeah.
Hey, Lauren
I mean,
Graham.
Everyone is in that. Okay. Diane Downs / a remake of Small Sacrifices. The original starred the late Farrah Fawcett, and she was excellent in that for whatever reason. I don't actually think it's because she's all that good an actor, but she hit the spot right there. Diane Downs, as some of you may remember, tried to kill her children and pretended that she was carjacked, and there was a lot of weirdness in the courtroom. Murphy or Wolf?
That's Murphy, because Sarah Paulson would play Diane Downs. So that answers that question.
Okay. Yeah, I have to agree. The next one, I'm very interested to hear what you think of what your pick is for this one. The Staircase. This is the Michael Peterson case. There was a French documentary series about it some years ago with a follow-up as his appeal proceeded along its tracks. It was an English language documentary. It's available on Sundance now. If you've never seen it, you should watch it. Murphy or Wolf for this one?
This is one of the only ones I think where both of them could do a good job, just because of the nature of the case. Both of them have done good stuff in terms of the fabulously wealthy and marital difficulties, and they would totally feel very different to me, but I'd be kind of interested in both. If you're making me flip a coin, I might go Murphy.
I would like to see both versions, but I'm going to go Wolf, and here's why. It's a very close decision, because I think the fact that Peterson's sexuality was made into an issue that evidentiarily it probably shouldn't have been in his initial trial, I think Murphy might do a better job of unpacking that. But then there's the owl theory, which I won't elaborate on in case you've never seen this series, so you can discover it for yourself. But I just don't want Ryan Murphy anywhere near the owl theory. Just don't, or any owl theory about anything. So I'm going to go Wolf. Our next case is the subject of the documentary The Imposter. I believe it's still available on Netflix. There were also a couple of New Yorker articles about it. The perpetrator there is Frederick Bourdin. He pretended to be a missing child, like complete with, you know, he had to dye his hair. He didn't really speak English. The child had gone missing from Texas. It's a lot. It's quite an amazing case. Bourdin has a history of doing this. He's the James Hogue of Europe. I am going to go Murphy on that one. What say you?
Yeah, no, it's Murphy. It's too strange, I think, for Wolf to quite be able to capture the oddity of it all. And I think that this feels very much in Murphy's wheelhouse, because he's interested in identity. And
I would just love to see Kathy Bates as the mom, because she has a sort of textured character in the documentary, even though she's a real person, is really quite something. I hesitated to put this case on the list because I think it's been just done to death. But I'm wondering if it's possible, but so is Menendez. I'm wondering if it's possible to do something cool on the Black Dahlia. Alan, who would do a better job, Murphy or Wolf?
It's really been picked over. If someone's going to make a good thing out of it, I feel like it would be Murphy. Murphy could also make an utterly awful and self-indulgent version of it. I just don't feel like the Wolf creative team would be able to have an interesting enough spin on it to be worth
it. Yeah, I have a feeling that's true. I'm not sure. I mean, based on what we've seen from Wolf, first of all, like period stuff, he doesn't have the lightest touch, and he hasn't done super well with stuff set in LA. I don't think that that's as much his wheelhouse. So I would go Murphy for this too. Next up, Bambi Bembenek, allegedly framed for the murder of her husband's ex-wife, also escaped to Thunder Bay, Ontario from prison with her handsome boyfriend, who wrote a book about it that is so terrible that I gave up 6 pages in. Bambi Bembenek, Murphy or Wolf?
Probably Wolf, I think. Slightly more down-to-earth case overall.
Yeah, I think that tracks. It was from the Midwest, which he apparently is quite fond of. I kind of want to see Ryan Murphy's take on like her life after she just sort of pleaded and took time served. Because she did jump out a window and had to have her leg amputated. This was not during the escape. This is when she claimed Dr. Phil producers were harassing her so hard for an episode that she leaped out a second story window and broke her leg so badly that it had to be amputated. Charges were never filed in this case. She had a lot of problems. So I'm going to say Murphy for that one. And as our last entry, the continuing fascination for this case, totally understandable to me. Dick Wolf has done a couple of takes on it in the Law and Order franchises. I'm speaking, of course, of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. Murphy or Wolf?
You've just answered your own question. I think I'd like to see Murphy do it because, you know, we're seeing with Menendez, Dick Wolf taking on a case he's done a couple of different variants on already. Let's have a fresh take on it. I don't know that I relish Murphy, you know, doing so lurid a case, but at least there would be something a bit more novel about it.
I agree. I don't think I like Wolf's takes on Bernardo Homolka, but I don't think we need another one. And this is at the end of the day, my main issue with Menendez is like, why are we still caring about this case? Like, everything's been said and done. Why did he start there? So I'd rather not have him return to that well. I agree with you. It would be probably a little tacky, Murphy's take on it, but that's all right. I'm a little tacky myself. And that is our cold case, the very first cold case Would You Rather session. Thank you, Alan, for humoring me on that. Please tell listeners where else they can find your work this week.
Well, the big work this week that's coming out on Tuesday is Breaking Bad 101, The Complete Critical Companion. It is a collection of reviews of every single episode of the series, some of which you've seen online because I recapped virtually the whole run over the years. But almost all of those have been either edited, rewritten, or thrown out and started over from scratch. So there's a lot of new content in there. There's a foreword by Damon Lindelof. There's an introductory and outroductory, that's not a word, essay about the show and what made it great and what made it so important. And it's just sort of, it's a nice thing, whether you're doing a rewatch of the show and want to have it next to you to look at after each episode, or you just sort of want to, you know, look back on memories of the show and see what I had to say about Fly or Ozymandias or something. I think it's a really interesting read, and obviously I'm biased, but it also looks great. The design that Abrams and their team did is really marvelous. So that's one thing. I, you know, review TV every day at UpRocks. I'm on Twitter at Seppenwall, and I have a podcast called TV Avalanche.
And he's also the winner of the Extra Hot Podcasts, Law and Order Draft. Thank you so much for...
Well, how did no one take Jack McCoy first?
Well, but there were a bunch of Jack McCoys. We had other plans. I had to have Logan, and it cost me. Oh, thank you so much for being with us, Alan. I hope that you will return. And speaking of returning, next week it's an almost wanted. Annabeth Chow is Anna back for Mindhunters and The 11. We're going to take on that Capote thing from that Berlinger guy. And of course, you can always hear me and my girl T-Bone on The Blotter Presents Summary Judgment, where we look back at each individual episode of Law & Order True Crime, The Menendez Murders. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm your host. You can find me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. You can follow this very podcast at Blotter Presents on both Twitter and Facebook. And we will talk to you next time.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.